ready for the interview. And if you get a cue live on a laptop, watch what I'm gonna do. Welcome to the show, let them know we got a point of view. Hey, yo, let's have a combo. Say what you feel, be real, that's the motto. Real talk, pronto, Dr. D, PhD, hit an intro. Hold up, wait, gotta be social. Network global, a home for the locals. Gotta be social, network global, a home for the locals.
We just had a big conversation before we hit record here. Jesse, you seem lovely. You just seem like a very nice, bubbly person to me.
Ditto.
Thank you. She's been listening to my voice for a very long time.
I have been. I feel like I know you just from listening to your podcast.
You know you're going to get some probably different questions, right?
Come on, that's totally great. And I have really enjoyed the ones where it's you too, though, to sort of like hear you talking about something.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm into a bunch of different stuff, but now we're into you, Jess. And I think when you reached out, I found your background really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. It like resonated with me. So let's dive in a little bit about your background, what you're up to.
Sure.
Take us back. I like to go backwards. We're going to rewind the tape, the story.
Yeah. Well, let me just say today, like, I am a social worker by trade, and I've been in social work for like almost 20 years, over 15 years. But I didn't like land in that space. You know, it's sort of, social work is sort of built in you based on life experiences and things that show up in your life. And sort of this deep need to be interconnected with the collective has just always been a part of who I am. And I love people. Like, I love differences and I love getting to know people. And I have always been a curious soul. And so I sort of was directed into social work and thought I'd do like therapy. Right? I thought, oh, that's how I'll get deeply connected to different people. I ended up in child welfare and seriously found a part of myself that I didn't even know was there. And so I've never left. That's the specialized area that I'm in and I love. You know, people think you're crazy for saying you love child welfare because it really does entail child protection. But I have had the honor to meet people that I would have never met otherwise. And so it's been, and at really tough times that otherwise could have, you know, otherwise, a lot of people are quick to judge. And so I've really gotten to see beauty within like people turning pain into purpose. And so that's how I landed in child welfare. I was in this public system for a long time as a child protection worker, then as a supervisor. And it just started to feel like pantyhose too tight. I was like, I can't do what I want to do. I can't use the word love in my work. This isn't because of the boundaries that are around the system and the profession. I thought I need to figure out a way that I can use this, you know, like the base of love. Because if you don't love who you're working with, then what is it built on? So I went out and I thought I can do, because I love reflection, curiosity. I went out and I thought I'm going to merge all of these things I love: emotional intelligence, infant mental health, coaching, professional coaching, kind of the tenets of that, and turn them into something in service to the child welfare and human service system, but that keeps me with and connected, but not within and stuck. And so I've sort of merged into that field where it's like professionals and leaders, and I'm doing coaching and training and still some child welfare specific training. And I get to work with the workers. You know, the only tangible tool any child protection system has is the worker. And so I get to still really nurture the person in the work. So that's how I came full circle. And now I have my own business, which is wonderful because I'm also the mother of five.
It's a lot of work.
I have to find something that's balanced. And then here I am.
All right. So now you started it. Now all these questions just are populating. And this is how it works for me. What is the current state of the child welfare system and what needs to be done to change it? Because I imagine it's not good.
It's not. It's really, really poor. The well-being of children and families is really poor right now. And it isn't because there aren't a lot of good people in the field wanting to do really good work. It's just, it's not set up well to support children and families.
What does that mean? Not set up well.
It's not like, for me, the reason I couldn't be in it is because I couldn't genuinely be my connected self. I couldn't say to a kid that was in foster care that I love you. I've spent 2 years with you and your family and driving you here and flying with you to Florida to see your aunties and your grandmas. And I really love you. but you can't say that because of how boundaried it is as a system. And so I wanted to be able to say that to kids. And I wanted families to be able to feel like, I'm not talking at you, I'm working with you. I really do want you to be well, but the system is not set up because it's overwhelmed. There's too many process pieces like paperwork and things that keep you disconnected from families that then keeps families unwell and makes workers unwell. And you have this terrible clash of people's whys, clash of what people need, all because of like these really constraint pieces that are keeping children and families unwell all the way around.
I mean, I feel like this has always been an issue. Like, why isn't this being changed? Like, what's the problem? Like, why can't we turn this around or is it much deeper than just the system?
I think it's deeper. And I think, you know, this is going to probably not resonate with everybody, but for me personally, I think because of where powers lay for certain systems, the right people aren't prickled enough by the problem.
The right people. What does that mean?
Like, not everybody feels as if they have a role in the welfare of children and families. So all of us do. There's not any of us that are free from playing a role in the welfare of children and families. It might mean be kinder to your neighbor. It might mean if you know kids, if you have kids, if you care about kids, you have a role in the welfare of children and families. But we put it onto a system, and a system is not built. Well, and ours certainly isn't built that way, but it isn't built to care. And so if we don't care, the system's not built to care. The problem stays kind of containered instead of collectively owned.
It's weird. Like, why is the system not built to care? I mean, isn't the point of it to care? I mean, like,
anybody that's in it is built to care, but the structure is not built to care. It's very constrained in, you know, like it, they focus so much on worker accountability in a lot of the systems I do work with. And I think I've been in the work, you're working whenever a family needs you to be there, but it doesn't look like an 8-to-5. So it's really hard within a business model to structure what people are doing and when. And in a relationship, I could spend an hour talking to you that's really meaningful, but maybe I'm only supposed to be there 15 minutes. Well, so that it's not set up for human connection to be the primary focus.
Has it deteriorated even more from the time that you started, or?
I think it's been bad. I mean, I don't think it's been like a robust working system. I think awareness of maybe just how poor and how unwell people are staying within it, like worker well-being and family served, is the awareness is becoming greater. We're really having great awareness of all of the inequity among the system. I mean, it's becoming, we're no longer in a space where people are thinking like, oh, we should revamp or rebuild. It's really at the point of you have to start over.
Yes. Yes. Actually, I feel like a lot of systems are like that. Actually, it's like so poorly done. It's like you can just keep throwing things at it. It's like, okay, it's still mediocre to terrible.
Your base isn't good enough to hold anything to rebuild that's going to look well.
Okay. So from your point of view, what would starting over look like? And this, I guess, is hypothetical because probably not going to happen beyond reality, like currently, unless there's something you know that I don't know about it. What would that be, the starting over? What would that look like?
I think it's going to be collective care. So I think we can't make it be a system problem. It has to be a collective problem. We really do have to collectively care about families and not have a system that is in savior mode where they take from and build better. That doesn't work. You know, like if you don't take kids out of their system and they become better because you put them somewhere, it doesn't work like that. We know that. I mean, I have 5 kids. They were built by me and my husband. They are part of us. You have to keep them connected to that lineage and legacy in safer ways, but we need collective care. We need people that, like, the whole system would have to start over from the base of families know themselves better than we're going to know them.
Well, like, it seems like kind of the genesis of this is the family, the structure of the family.
Yeah.
Which, how do you attack something like that when it's so private and personal to people? And then there's all this inequality Mm-hmm. How do you, because it's like just addressing the symptoms, but the real issue is maybe the structure of where people live.
Yes.
People who are living in very difficult situations, mm-hmm. having lots of children. Mm-hmm. Like just seems like it's just overwhelming, honestly.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the conditions of it are overwhelming.
So it's just hard for me to envision how you approach that as a mm-hmm. system and go without people saying, stay out of my business.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, it really would be like a grand conscious awakening for it ever to right. look radically different. Because people do the stay out of my business. And so that's part of the problem, is the barrier of stay out of my business until it's not voluntary anymore that I'm in your business.
Yeah.
But there's nobody, you know, I mean, I can think of every single family that I worked with. There is not one exception that didn't want support and help. They just didn't know how to get it.
Yeah.
Or what we told them they needed to do to be successful, they didn't have access to. So it wasn't like, I didn't meet a single parent that woke up and said, I'd really like to be a terrible parent today. That's really my goal.
Right.
None, not one.
Of course. Man.
So the worthiness of being seen as a person and not thought of as a problem is always there. That's the base. We just haven't used it as the base.
So was your work child protection with also foster and adoption? Did you do adoption as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love adopt. We adopted my daughter
mm-hmm.
and through Catholic Charities, mm-hmm. We went through. And just even going through that process and working with our social worker, it was like really eye-opening.
Yes.
And I think a lot of things in life, you have a bias against until you actually are exposed to that mm-hmm. bias.
Absolutely.
So take us through, I want to jump back a little bit mm-hmm. because I really don't think a lot of Americans know this. What does it take to become a social worker?
Yeah.
And what are the qualities of a really good social worker?
So I would say the core has to be any really solid person that's going to social work's going to find them cares about people. I mean, they genuinely care about wellness of others. Now, I would pose that as they receive education and have access to life experiences, they become to care about all people. You know, we don't start we care about what we can see developmentally as kids and what we have access to. But good social work education exposes you to many different things that you wouldn't have ever considered. And you start to collectively care about all people. It doesn't, you know, behaviors aside, it doesn't matter anything that people have done. All people have value and worth. And so good education builds that. And then it is, you know, it's a professionalized profession where it is standardized by license. And, you know, people have to have passed exams and gone to so much school. And then there's grad school and there's doctorate, depending on what you want to do with it. So a good social worker is built foundationally on really solid education. Now, there are gaps, right? There are gaps in knowledge and learning, but there are some really, really beautiful schools of social work in our country that have some really great foundation that builds what was already stirring in the person that found social work.
How do social workers take care of themselves when they're mm-hmm. exposed to all of this mayhem with the system and broken homes, things of that nature?
You know, that's where I found reflection. And that's why I've now made it my career, is they have to take pauses. They have to take pauses and feel the feelings of the work. You have to be able to feel, this was really terrible what happened in this family, and look all the way around and get curious about why and how come that might have happened. See the humanity in the people that might have caused the harm so that you can do the good work. See the child. You have to be able to slow down. That's what keeps you well. And you have to have somebody, because it's a confidential profession. So you can't go talk to your husband or you can't go talk to a therapist. It has to be built into the system that you have space to really process and debrief through really hard things so that your feelings don't become that family's burden.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I wonder what was surprising to you when you started, like you're brand new, Jess, and what were you like, whoa, this is crazy.
I think for me, what I've always known there's power in connection with people, right? I've always experienced it, but I didn't know it at the level I knew it once I got into this work. And the power of relationship and being in connection with somebody is so therapeutic and healing. You know, I remember being in people's homes and they are mad. They do not want you there.
Yeah.
But that's only the surface of what's there. There are so many times that that's a protection from deep, meaningful connection because they've also been wounded in relationships. And so finding the meaning and connection and really like honoring that somebody may allow you into that space with them, it was more beautiful than I could have ever expected it to be.
I would imagine so. What's the status of the social work field right now in America? Like, is it understaffed?
Yes.
Yes, understaffed. Health-based service. Of course it is.
Yeah. It's understaffed. It's underpaid. It's undervalued. It is, again, the power of human connection. People are aware is there. And you have all of these people that go through this professional training that's what they want to do. They want to afford people connection and be in connection with others. And we boundary their work so much that we make them unwell. And then they leave it.
Is it a profession that, is there a lot of turnover?
High
turnover?
Social work, different fields, right? You could, social work by design, you can go into business. You know, the MSW is the new MBA because they're great leaders. Child protection though, the turnover rate is catastrophically high to the point that people, the average, I think, is 2 years in the field.
That's it.
And so think of all the cost of training. It really is so heartbreaking. But yeah, it's the average across the country is 2 years. There are some systems that are more well that keep people longer. And then there are some where they have high turnover every year.
Why is the pay so low in these type of things?
Because I think it's an unseen profession, because if you see it, then you have to acknowledge you have a role in the work too. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That was very profound. Like, we don't want to be exposed to this. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see this. We have to participate. Isn't that a crazy thing that humans do? It's like, listen, I'm going to undervalue this because I don't want to face this. Mm-hmm. Like, this is happening. I just don't want to acknowledge it and see it. I just want to like keep it away from me, type of thing.
And they're children and often very, you know, impoverished families or underserved families. So their voices are not loud to help advocate for the need of the service either. I mean, people don't listen to kids like they listen to adults.
Another great line. I mean, like,
they don't.
What do you hear from the kids? Like, what are the kids like? What are they saying?
You know, most of the time, they're so, what I often hear is how much they love their families. Yeah. It doesn't matter what people have done. They seriously, genuinely know how to love people unconditionally. If only we could learn from these children. They know how to uncondition love to a level that I've never seen before. I mean, only children possess that ability to truly uncondition their love. They're not like, oh, I love you, mom, but only if you're nice to me today. Yeah. They truly love them all of the time.
Isn't it amazing how like, there are people who treat their children so poorly and the kids still love them so much.
All the time.
It always surprises me. Like the kids just have this bucket of love that just never ends. And it's like, it's incredible, actually.
It is. And what's fun is to help the parents see it. Because once you see, oh my gosh, this person is truly unconditionally loving me, it motivates you to want to be a better person.
Yeah.
So even as a parent, like, wow, you really have weathered and forgiven. I want to reapply that lens to self and I want to try to do that for myself. Does it take a long time sometimes? Sure. And do kids sometimes have to be with other people? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there isn't some, you know, loving connection that still should be nurtured, even if it's just the knowing. You know, like for kids, they just want to know who they are. That's what they want to know.
Yeah. It was it. This is a commentary about kind of what I see. I'm not in that aspect of things, but like when we are reaching out, we're talking about you being on the podcast. I'm like, wow, this is right up my alley because this is an area that needs exposure.
It does.
But in podcasting, so much of the pitching of stories is about how to make six-figure income, imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. Like everybody's a health coach or a life coach. Like I'm not trying to devalue it, but it's like, it's just kind of the same pitch over and over. I can make you money. I can get you more leads. But these stories are so rare. I rarely see people pitching about social work, or even like the other day, I interviewed a prostitute, you know, like a sex worker, right? It's like, I want to investigate the stories that are not being discussed, or that people say, I don't want to talk about this. No, actually, you do want to talk about it. Yeah. We need people to highlight these things for that. And this is
that's
an area
I love, the unscripted part. Like, just have conversations with people where you don't have to sell something. You just learn. And
that's exactly right. Because I'm asking this question for myself, honestly, because I don't know a lot about it, but somebody listening to this is going to think, I don't know anything about the social work system and child protection and welfare. All they know is what they saw in some documentary type, which is great, or some sensationalized thing. But what's the nitty gritty stuff? Actually happening? You know,
there's so much goodness. So I don't want to negate, there are really terrible things that happen in our world, and kids are really poorly harmed. And they do sensationalize that and make documentaries, and they do really poorly display the social worker. Social workers do make mistakes, though. They do. I mean, I have been in the position where you don't see what you didn't know, right? Like, if you don't have a level of self-awareness, you can really do more harm than good. Not intentionally, but there are so many people doing such hard work, connecting with people who's have burned the bridges with every family member they have. And you are literally the only person that will come and sit at their kitchen table with them and find them a valuable human. I mean, people are spending these moments and time with families and kids at their dinner tables. And, you know, I can think of a time, there was a mom, we had a great relationship. So here was the power of connection. But I walked in, she's screaming mad. She is pounding on the stove mad. I can feel her breath in my face mad. And I was not scared one bit, because I saw her. I saw this super scared mom that had all these protective defenses built up, but she needed somebody to see her. And so that's what's happening in these moments that are unseen, because they're happening at somebody's kitchen table where nobody else is, you know, nobody else has access to. But then that person is going home, like me, with that deep, meaningful connection, but not a lot of resources on what to do with that. Right. I mean, there's not a lot of therapists in the world. There's not a lot of mental health services. There's not a lot of addiction services.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, I think about in your work in this, how has your work in this affected your parenting with your children?
It a lot. You know, I think I look at my kids developmentally and notice things that I wouldn't have otherwise noticed. Hmm. And I also have, over years of experience, developed a level of self-awareness that tells me when I'm starting to get burnt out in the work too, based on go drive by every house and there must be an adolescent who's being harmed in these houses just by look. I know that that's my fear response being triggered, because I need to do something about my own wellness. And so it has impacted me. I cannot live and work in the same county, you know, or with the same, because I do not want to know all of that stuff about all of my neighbors and all of my kids' parents and their friends. I know myself that would influence the genuine path I let them take through the world. So it has made me have, you know, boundaries are the new black, like really clear boundaries on where I can stay well within the work.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you would think that like in that job that they would hire a few people to come around and just check on the social workers. Like, does that exist at all? Like, that seems obvious to me.
No, I know. They don't do this for nurses or doctors or social workers.
It just seems obvious. Like,
that's what I think. I was literally talking to somebody about that yesterday. Like, this is so obvious. It doesn't make sense how you couldn't see it. But it is, I mean, they're weighted down with too much work. There's not enough time to get people to commit to even working with me an hour a month. The person will do it, but their system struggles to give them that hour.
That's insane. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we're so now into this sense of like mental health. We should be hiring mental health advocates or specialists to be helping people in social work and healthcare sciences, whatever. Say, come here, you're required to come sit with me during your shift because we need to download the stuff, you know, like.
There are some that are doing it. And my hope is the ones that are investing in doing that are really taking robust data that shows that well-being is being impacted and nurtured, that then people will buy in. You know, everyone does well if there's numbers around it.
It's crazy. So you got to have numbers for this stuff. Like, it seems obvious. What do you need the numbers for? Why do you need numbers? To persuade some person with money? Oh, okay, right. It's, the data looks good. Let's spend some money on this. Dude, you already know what is going on. Like, it's... Mm-hmm. It's crazy to me. Like, what do you need the numbers for? Like, so obvious.
Because of the way business is run. Yes, I agree. It is obvious. And anyone in the work would say that it is. Their well-being is what is often sacrificed.
What's the future of social work? Like, I know there's different avenues of it, but what do you want it to be?
I have a lot of positive hope, like active hope for the field of social work, because there's so many people within it that want to change it and move it. And so I think there's momentum building. You know, there's that quote that says systems don't change, people change, and then people change the system. Like, that is the social workers. And so I feel the momentum behind, like, pushing, you know, my friend Cherish will say pushing the status quo, and I feel that happening. And so I have hope that we are moving in the right direction. Like, the time is now for social work. I mean, the world has been in sheer disarray. So the time is now for caring.
Yeah. I mean, I know, like, forever, like, people say, oh, you know, people in these professions are just woefully underpaid. And, you know, your teachers, your social work, everybody lumps all that in. You know, it's the people working on the ground level, right?
Yep.
But I always see, like, what's changing? Like, when are we going to start respecting this more? But see, it's different if, like, if you're an entrepreneur, or you got your own business, you have the options to make more money, right? But you're in a system that you are limited by a system. It just seems crazy to me. I don't know.
Didn't the pandemic sort of show that, though? Like, for me, I always had asked, I had a mentor ask me once, who benefits from children and families being unwell? And that has literally rattled in my brain for 15 years. Who benefits from children and families being unwell? And of course, I have 1,000 philosophies around what, but then the pandemic came and we literally shut the world down.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, we can move in one instant if we need to.
Sure.
If this impacts everybody and they collectively feel an impact, we can move.
Yeah.
So, you know, it brings me to, we need to shake up the understanding and everyone needs to be touched a little by this. Well, like, the world collectively had felt this unwellness. Maybe it will move us towards collective caring.
Maybe. I
mean, I'm going to have hope.
are there advocates for social workers, like, that can lobby for things? Like, there's, you know, like, I just don't know. I'm curious, you know?
Yeah. So the NASW, which is the National Association for Social Workers, has a really, I mean, they're active and robust to sort of, like, really amplify this profession. And the current President Mitt is very active in lobbying and making sure that what social work is capable of doing and the possibility behind this profession. I mean, she is out there doing that work along with many people that are, you know, members. I think the hard part is social work really is passions professionalized. And so to sort of wrangle that and sort of lobby it is a little difficult. So they've built system barriers, right? We've built a professional barrier, but that's also where I got a little bit stuck in the work, is because we professionalized my passion of caring and helping, I also got a little disconnected to it because I couldn't use me. You know, I'm like a love-based person. I couldn't use all of me in the work that was constrained within that system.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like a very simple yet complex thing.
I know.
You know what I mean? Like, it feels like so simple, the solutions, but it feels like it's just so complex at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very frustrating.
It's frustrating. And it is complex because everybody is unique. You and I are unique. Yeah. There is not anybody a social worker can work with that's going to be the same. And so becoming prescriptive and doesn't really work.
Yeah. I want to get back to parenting a little bit. I want to dive deeper into, you talked a little bit about some things you notice and burnout and stuff, but what are some lessons that you teach to your children that you've learned because of working with children in the social worker system?
I think for sure it's the collective care. You know, the like you sit with somebody on the bench, I don't care if you like them or don't like them, everybody has value, you know, and then we unpack if some, well, I don't really like him. Okay, but now we're going to talk about why and how come, because a lot of that is, you know, like conditioned constraints. Well, they do this or they don't, you know what I mean? It's our kids are so nurturable that they're also nurturable to open their perspectives and have them quickly be able to consider why and how come and get curious, because they naturally ask why 1,000 times anyways. It's really the parents that shut down the why, because I said so. Like, you know, nurture the why. I mean, they're genuinely curious, and we're going to build open-minded thinkers if we nurture the curiosity.
Why do you think people lose? I feel like people lose that sense of curiosity as you get older. What's your thoughts about that?
That is, like I was listening to you talk about, I think it is linked in homogenous thinking, and homogenous thinking is safe and comfortable and gives really clear parameters. And I think as adults, the, you know, we get really conditioned to pick a lane and stay in that lane.
And you know what's weird about that too? Often we pick this lane, we actually don't even know much about it. Like, I don't like, you ever have somebody explain their position on something and you realize they actually don't know anything about their own position? Yeah. I actually find that that's the case with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like, as soon as you ask the person, that's why I always ask, like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Because I'm always in pursuit of explanation from other people.
Yes, but why?
Why does that mean? Why do you think, what is, like, if you say something to me, I'm like, what is that? Like, I don't, that's like an obvious next question. What is that? Like, you never ask that question. You're just blindly going, yeah, sounds good, you know.
But like, we get conditioned to not, the curiosity doesn't get conditioned to what leads us. We get conditioned to pick a thought and keep a thought.
Yeah, to pick a thought and keep a thought. Mm-hmm. It's like this mental prison. Like, you put yourself in.
Yes.
Like, I'm here, I'm stuck in this prison, but I don't even know what it is that I'm stuck in. Like, I'm just moving forward with it, you know? And it's kind of like this bias. And I think we suffer from that in, I mean, a lot of places in the world, but it's certainly in the US from my perspective, this closed-mindedness, this homogenous thinking is so bad. It's so bad. Even when
part of it is because of when it happens.
Yes.
So developmentally, we're collectively involved in people's success, you know, like from birth. I mean, they have to be, or they don't live. And then we help them to a certain point, and then they become these adolescents. So they look like big adults, and then we don't let them be curious anymore. Yeah. It's now pick a path. You're 17. What are you going to do with the rest of your life? Like, what 17-year-old would know that? But we're boxing them in to have homogenous thinking, pick a lane and keep a lane.
I told my daughters the other day, she was saying some stuff she wanted to do. I said, the truth is you have no clue what you're going to be doing. Like, you're 10. Like, don't put this pressure on yourself. Like, you have no clue what you're going to be into.
No, like, I didn't. I switched majors because I was young. I graduated high school at 17. And so I went right to college. And I think I switched majors, I don't know, 8 times probably before I picked something. Sociology is what I graduated first with. And then went back to social work because I got into the world and I'm like, no, this is where I'm most aligned. I need to do this. But I think we lack curiosity and we have homogenous thinking because of developmentally when we start to cage people's thoughts at this really robust, innovative. Teenagers are magnificent because they're creative geniuses. I mean, but we can't harness it because it's kind of a lot to manage.
You feel like there's like stereotypes about teenager behavior that maybe we can talk a little bit about here. I feel like everybody tells you the same thing, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, they're going to be terrible. You know, I was like,
they do say that.
Everybody's so bad.
I use this with parents that I would work with that had teenagers that they were really struggling with. Like, now imagine that your, you know, 15-year-old was 2 and he's in the middle of a mall and he's screaming. You know how many people would come to help him? Anybody. Mm-hmm. Anybody that was around would come to this 2-year-old. Now just fast forward 13 years. That's nothing in the scheme of development. A 15-year-old is screaming, they're calling the cops.
Yes.
Nobody's helping. So it's like this weird time when they still need the same responses, the same nurturing. They're completely cut off from it. And so, of course, they get compartmentalized to, you know, self-rely. And then we lose connection to collective because we're supposed to manage ourselves. It doesn't.
Oh man, it's just weird to me. Like, I was not a disgruntled teenager. I wasn't a problem teenager. Yeah, I was like, and every time people tell me this, I'm like, I don't know. I've seen a lot of people who weren't. Why are you feeding this thing to me? Like somebody told you that. Like, yeah. Somebody told you that all teenagers are just, oh, just wait. They turn into this and it's terrible. I mean, it may happen to my daughter, but I don't know. I wasn't though. I know a bunch of people who weren't assholes as like teenagers. Mm-hmm. Like this is what I'm saying, this thinking, you know, like.
And maybe even the perception of what people are saying is assholes is really just leadership skills developing. I mean, right. Truly, like even some of the really, you know, teens are really, really hard to find places to live if their families won't care for them because of this view of teenagers. And often these kids had such resilient, not that they should have had to be resilient, but resilient leadership skills. They could engage people in a way. I thought the only thing that's wrong with this is what we're letting them nurture through this, not the skill itself. I mean, the skill itself is great.
Yeah. Like they're just all bad or something. Like it's just such ridiculous thinking. Like I always challenge anybody. Like, I don't know. I wasn't like that, man. They're like, oh, you weren't? I'm like, no. Like, and actually, I know a lot of people who weren't like that. They're not all terrible. Like,
and are you experiencing a 10-year-old that's bad? Because I know my children are not acting like.
No, I actually would be shocked if my daughter turned into this mean, crazy person. Like, I would be shocked. Mm-hmm. But I think some of it, though, is, let's just be honest here. I like to be very transparent, honest. Yeah. Some of it is your parenting. It's like cause them to be crazy.
Yes.
Like people don't like to look inward and go, maybe I'm the reason my kid's crazy. It's like, I just had an episode with Dr. Kristen Eccleston, who works with mental health and children. And you don't recognize how much your parenting can destroy your child's mental health. Maybe you're the problem.
Often you've impacted it, but the part that's so hard is we have so much judgment around if you acknowledge your parenting has done something to your kids. There's not one of us that hasn't impacted our kids in a negative way.
Of course, exactly.
Not one of us. But we don't give space for people to own that. And even like, you know, if you look into development and lineage, my daughter, because women are born with every follicle they're going to have, was inside my mother. And in me, you know what I mean? Like the things that are impacting these kids are so far back and so deeply rooted in DNA and legacy that of course your parenting and your mother's parenting and the way they were parent is impacting all of your kids.
Yes.
So just acknowledge the good and the bad and figure out what you want to change.
Yeah. I don't like this straightforward thinking all the time. It's like, well, just get ready. You're in for a terrible time. They'll come back to you at like 17 or something like that. I'm like, I'm just not buying this all the way.
And I would wonder the ones that do, what happened to them? What happened to them to make them unruly?
Yeah. I just think we don't question these things enough. But there's like a line because like there's questioning things and being intelligent questioning and really having thoughtful questions, responses, and then there's a line where it crosses into like really crazy thinking and conspiratorial craziness to certain things. You have to be very careful of being discerning about how you discuss these things. You know, like I think, like for me, like I have had 453 conversations on this podcast, and I have been think about all the information that's flooding my mind from all different spheres of influence. I could be easily swayed by almost a lot of these thoughts and opinions, but I always decompress and think, okay, what was that about? And like I'm gonna do after this, what do I think about social work after this?
Self-reflection
yes
is it's literally the first level of growing and enhancing your emotional intelligence. Is you have to have a really strong self-reflection practice. You have to know yourself to be yourself.
Right. Because sometimes you get introduced to something and you don't reflect on it. And that something may be extremely negative for you to get into. And I interview a lot of people in cults and stuff have been in. They think it's harmless initially. Mm-hmm. They never reflect on if it actually is something negative. It just, they found something that they feel wanted and loved and cared about. All the meanwhile, they're getting isolated from other people. They're not reflecting on it. Type of thing, you know?
But the base is the connection, the belonging and the connection is what they were seeking and wanting. And then it's the discernment of, is this bringing me the true connection and belonging that, you know, my soul is seeking? And if you do that, there are moments of interruption or whatever, you know, I mean, there are moments that you would be able to see, this isn't giving what I'm looking for.
Yeah. How has your work affected your, not like your, not your familial relationships, but like friendships and those types of things?
So I used to be considered an extrovert, you know, like I'm a recovering people pleaser. So I was considered, I was extroverted and always doing something with everybody. I have found that I am incredibly introverted, but also I like people. So, I mean, I have an extroverted side and I'm really outgoing, but I have to be alone. And so that self-discovery is really what's impacted those that have been used to me always saying yes and always being there. So I would say my circle has shrunk significantly, but those within it are very meaningful people. You know, the relationships really feed me and them. That's been a road. I mean, that's been a probably an ever-evolving road for me to find my tribe.
I mean, I could sense that just looking at you. That was like, soon as I asked that question, something changed. There was a look on your face like, oh, this has been tough work.
Yeah, it has. It really has. That's been the, because, you know, somebody once said to me, everyone has a reason, a season, or, you know, everyone's in your life, a reason, a season, or a lifetime. And that's been really helpful for me because there are those lifetime people, but there are a lot of those seasoned people that felt like friendships that would never go away. And as they sort of did, I thought, wow, I'm finding the opportunity and learning those. You know, I see all the reasoned people in my life, like thank you reasons, but the seasoned people were the ones that were probably hardest to grapple with for quite a long time. Cause it was, you know, like when you start to see things that other people don't want to see, it can get prickly.
I could look at you. I could just tell, like, this is a common thing with so many people I've talked to. My wife has had the same thing kind of. This weirdly enough has never been a thing for me. I'm not saying I'm amazing. I have not. Yeah. I'm just saying, like, I don't know, like naturally I've always tiered people into different versions of relationships. So like, I would always see it coming when someone was a seasoned person. Like I knew it, I saw it coming. I was like, oh, this is a certain time. You know,
what do you think built the knowing of that? Because I think I have that now, but I did not have that before.
I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. Because I grew up in a military family and I always knew that things were going to end with people. So I knew the behaviors of when people were going to end things. I always knew when it was coming because it was always an end date. And I saw the behavior of the end date. So whenever I would meet somebody as an adult and they start exhibiting this end date behavior, I said, oh, this is going to be over soon. I know what this looks like. And I always had peace with it.
Yeah, what a beautiful radical awareness to get early in life. I mean, I'm sure it came with heartache, but
of course
radical
it does.
Awareness to get early in life as you walk through, like, I bet your awareness around that could help so many people that are walking towards it.
Yeah. The problem side though is that you become detached from people and you're like, you kind of become dead to it a little bit. So you're kind of like, well, okay, it's done. We're done. I'm having an emotion about this, you know, like, but to start having some, like, yeah, it is sad that we don't have this anymore. But on the other hand, it's, you kind of, you see the tea leaves. You're like, all right, we had an intense thing and I see it dropping off and I'm okay with it dropping off.
Yeah. Whereas, it's like radical acceptance.
Right. Whereas I would see other people I knew, like they would struggle with drop off. Like, why is this happening? Why? Like, it's just, like, just, it's going to happen. Like, it's going to be over in like a month. Guarantee it, man. Like, they're fading from you. You can just tell, like.
Oh, what? I bet that was good for your friends to know early in life. I did not have that skill early in life. I really was a deep connector. And so if I deeply connected, I'd assumed that deep connection was nurtured forever and always until I learned you can have deep connection and it doesn't have to be connected, you know, like physically forever.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, I think I experienced that like frequently throughout my life. Like I could have this real big intensity, hang out with somebody for a long time. And then I could just feel them not wanting to do it. It's the certain things they say and do. It may not even be anything like from my point of view, and there nothing happened. It's just like this natural fading, like they've moved into a different version of their life. And I immediately accept it. Immediately. Wow. But other people around me go, isn't that weird? Like that you were hanging out so much and then you're not anymore. I'm like, not really, honestly. It's like, it's just where we're at right now.
And I love you have a developmental anchor to where it came from. Like it was part of who you were because of how you grew up.
Yeah. Like, and then you could still talk to the person, have a great different version of that relationship. You're just not going to be tethered like you were physically. I just accept it all. I just go, okay, it's just what it is. You know, it's like,
I'm right there with you now, but I did not get there as quickly.
I think it's weird that happened to me early, but I think it's primarily because of growing up in a military family situation.
You just did the developmental link, which is so important, even like for parents to be able to see where some of these things anchored and find the gifts in it versus like, this is what people do is if they have differences, they headbutt them.
Yeah.
Well, you should find meaning or you should have had a feeling. I'm like, no, you shouldn't. That's not how you developed. And for me, yes, I should have had feelings because that was part of my path to come to where I am. And then here we are today.
Right. And I think parenting too, it's like, I mean, obviously I've never had a child like leave home and be an adult, and that will happen at some point. But I also think like, I will be very sad about it, but I also understand the point of it.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to dwell on it and be like, I don't know why you want to do this. And some people do that. They're like, stay close to me. I'm like, listen, my job is to guide you up, you know, and it's more closer in the beginning. I have to be more hands-on and then I'm kind of letting go, you know, and I talked to my daughter about them. One day there's going to be a life where we don't exist in it regularly, like it is now.
Absolutely.
And I tell her that I'm like, that's just the reality of life more than likely. So it's not a surprise, you know, as much as I'm recognizing that there is a season with children.
Yeah.
In a season of super close, like the baby's born and you're everything, you're just constantly like they rely on everything. And then, you know, the relationship is it kind of that chasm starts growing, you know, the independence starts increasing, you know,
and you start to see the person,
you know, it goes from like helpless, needy to drunk roommate to regular roommate to like,
no kidding. Yes.
Yeah. And then like normal human being. And then like, hey, what's the freeloading going to stop? You know, it's like,
absolutely.
Trying to pay your way, human being. Yeah. You want that. But in a way, that's a seasonal relationship in many different ways. It changes.
Yeah. So I wonder, even based on that, probably all lifetime relationships have seasons.
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
Because even marriages have seasons.
Of course. You're living lifetimes within lifetimes in a marriage, in a friendship. Yes. And you're just, I mean, you look at your 20-year-old self and I'm 44, you're like, whoa, what just happened? Like, who is this person? Like, it's like cringeworthy when you look, you're like, ah. You know, people go, I wish I was 21 again. I'm like, no, you don't, man. You really don't. You're really stupid. Like,
you could not pay me to go back to that.
You're not that intelligent, man. It's like,
unless you sent me back with all of the awareness I have now. But what would happen then would not be what happened today. So no, you couldn't pay me to go back.
This is this is very high level thoughts about stuff like this. That's crazy. Jesse, I knew this would happen. It gets all over the place.
I love it. It's unscripted. It's beautiful. It goes where it's supposed to.
It goes where it's supposed to. The destination is to be determined.
Yes, it's a journey.
It's definitely a journey. Thank you so much for spending some time with me.
And, it was fun.
I learned a lot, man, about the social work system and in your life. So tell all the beautiful people how they can learn more about you.
Yeah, I have a website. So we can put that on there. www.rayofhopereflectivecoaching.com. I co-authored a couple books recently. One is about social work. Where social work can lead you.
There it is. Look at it.
And it's 24 different people. So find it on Amazon. 24 different social workers, well, professionals and leaders, telling their journeys, how they got into social work. So it's the person behind the profession.
Beautiful.
And it's a bunch of us sharing how we got into it or got out of it. You can find me through that and 23 other beautiful people. I'm on Instagram at reflective_coaching. I like to connect. So, I mean, I will never be mad if somebody wants to just like pop in my inbox and send me a message. I love to connect with people and just think and talk and unscripted like this. Yeah,
I love that. You're,
talk about the world.
You're the type of person that I am very gravitated towards.
Mm-hmm. Like, ditto.
Just jolly. Like you get on with them and they're like, just, they're just beautiful. They're just sunshine. They're rays of enjoyment and hope. And I just love that. Like, you know, if I get on with somebody and it's real stiff, I'm like, oh boy.
What are we going to do?
Got to loosen them up here. Here's my challenge. You got to loosen up, buddy.
I hear you. But that's a fun challenge sometimes too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's all fun. It's all a challenge. And it's like, I was telling a friend of mine today who texted me, it was like about their life. And they're like, oh man, do I say, you need to get to start doing stuff that you're supposed to do. Cause this life is short, man. I'm like,
oh, short.
Whatever you got to do, you want to do, you better start doing it now.
Yes. Don't get stuck by the constraints of this, our conditioned world. Like, do what you want to do.
You want to have fun? Do it now. Have fun.
Please do it.
Enjoy your life. Don't keep putting things off.
No. And take care of each other. Like, let's care about each other. And everyone will become well.
I totally agree. Jess, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it was fun.
Awesome. Jess, is it Hooper?
Hooper? Yep.
Hooper?
Yep.
Hooper. Score. All right. Thank you so much.
Yes, that was fun. Thanks.
All right.